Welcome back to Open Line, WOSU 820, NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, the United States is reported to be finalizing a policy for initiating diplomatic contact with Iran. That's a country that was kept diplomatically isolated through several presidential administrations. Is there a possibility for a less confrontational relationship between the U.S. and Iran? And how will the United States and its allies bring about what they want, an end to the possibility that Iran could gain nuclear weapons capability? We'll talk about these issues with the leading expert on Iran and U.S.-Iranian relations. Trita Parsi is president of the National Iranian American Council, an organization which promotes Iranian American participation in American civic life. His current book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the U.S. Welcome back, Trita Parsi. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
And we're at 614-292-8513. You can email questions or comments to openline at WOSU.org. Trita, well, let me ask you one thing. You've said that we've seen the arrest recently of an Iranian-American journalist, a woman, and also of a student. And you've written that apparently the Iranian government is targeting Iranian-Americans. Now, why are they doing that?
Well, it seems like part of the effort of some elements in the government to create problems and make it more difficult for any rapprochement or any dialogue between the United States and Iran. And at the same time, there is significant paranoia within the Iranian government about some of the activities of visiting Iranian Americans because of a fear that the U.S. is trying to orchestrate some sort of a velvet revolution in Iran.
Hmm.
But when you take a look at the people that they have been arresting, it really makes very little sense, and it seems to be more an effort to intimidate others rather than actually arresting people that have done anything in particular.
I mean, a student, after all, or a journalist.
Yeah.
And who would they want to intimidate?
Well, they know, for instance, that elements that are outside the country are obviously more inclined to see the reformist win. They're more inclined to see Iran take a new direction, and they're very negative towards Ahmadinejad and the conservative establishment. So by targeting people of that profile, they're intimidating others from coming there. I know fewer people are going, fewer journalists are visiting because of a fear that they may get arrested on completely trumped-up charges.
When they're arrested on these trumped-up charges, how long do they keep them in jail? Is it just a symbolic amount? I mean, a couple of weeks? Or, I mean, this woman journalist, this woman student recently arrested, are they still in jail?
They're still in jail, and usually they do get out after a couple of months, but only after they've paid some sort of a price, they're given some sort of a collateral to the Iranian government, so they keep them still in check. And even though so far there's not been any case of any very severe consequences of these arrests, it is still a tremendously traumatizing experience, of course, and it's creating significant problems.
For the individual, a traumatizing experience, absolutely. When you said they have to pay a certain price, you mean monetary or otherwise?
Well, we've seen a pattern in the past in which they let him off on bail, and as collateral, they have to give the deeds of their apartment in Iran or their parents' apartment in Iran or some other relative's apartment in Iran or something else that they own, so that in case they were to do anything or give a lot of negative interviews to Western press, the government may retaliate by taking over their possession.
So they blackmail them, essentially.
In a way, yes.
Yeah. What kind of a government does this? I mean, a government, I guess, that feels very threatened, I would imagine. Huh?
Well, a government that is, on the one hand, paranoid, but on the other hand, also feels that it is benefiting from creating a securitized atmosphere within the country because that makes it easier for itself to keep control.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen that pattern elsewhere.
Sure. Well, let's talk about you testified last week in Congress before a committee of the House against something called the Iran Sanctions Enabling Act. What is that? And you say that the sanctions now placed upon Iran by the United States are not effective in terms of causing Iran to stop the behaviors that we want to stop, like supporting militant groups like Hezbollah and like moving toward the potential for nuclear weapons. They don't work, you say, but they're also really impacting mostly the Iranian people. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Sure. We've had sanctions on Iran for more than two decades. In fact, probably for a full 30 years, but really intensified sanctions have been in place since 1995. And reality is that if these sanctions had been effective, we would not be facing a situation today in which the Iranian state would be more powerful and more problematic than it was back in 1995. So we have to be honest with ourselves and recognize that this is a tool that may be useful at certain circumstances, but it's not been helpful in this specific case. And as a result, it is tremendously problematic. It is an approach that has had several negative consequences elsewhere. Mm-hmm. For instance, it has affected the Iranian people much more negatively than it has affected the Iranian government. And it has, in a way, hampered the development of an indigenous pro-democracy movement, because to have a good indigenous pro-democracy movement, you need to have a wealthy middle class. You need to have a vibrant civil society. But the economic sanctions have directly or indirectly prevented that from really emerging. And that's a significant problem, particularly if Iran continues to be on the path towards a nuclear capability, because that would mean that the prospects of having a democratic Iran having that technology is becoming less as a result of the sanctions.
What are these sanctions exactly?
Well, we have comprehensive sanctions on Iran. There's almost no trade whatsoever except for some Persian drugs and some fruit and pistachio nuts. And even that is very limited. So back in 1994, trade between the United States and Iran stood at about $4 billion, and now it's less than $200,000-$300,000.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And there's no investments in Iran's energy sector, which means that, for instance, a few years ago when there was a shortage of oil, again, the sanctions were partly responsible for that, because the sanctions had prevented the development of the Iranian oil sector, which reduced the market capacity quite significantly. And reality is, these sanctions have been effective in causing Iran significant pain. There's no doubt about that. This has been very costly for Iran, but they've been unsuccessful in translating that pain into a change of policy, which at the end of the day is the real objective. We don't impose sanctions just to cause pain. We want to see a change in behavior. And we have not seen that in the climate.
Are these sanctions vis-a-vis the United States trade only, or also some of our European allies as well?
Well, we have sanctions in which we're actually targeting our companies of allied countries, because we don't want them to trade with Iran. We don't want them to invest in Iran. And this is just furthering the sense that the United States is not building consensus and building alliances. Rather, it's punishing countries, even friendly countries, if they do things that we don't agree with. And that only weakens America's position to really be able to rally an international consensus against Iran.
Mm-hmm. So it's not the case, then, that Britain or France or Germany have their own set of sanctions against Iran that parallel ours in some way?
They have some sanctions as well, oftentimes put against Iran under pressure from the United States, but there are also other sanctions that would be targeting their companies against their wishes, of course. And the bill that was up in Congress in the subcommittee last week would permit pension funds in this lousy economy to make investment decisions not on the economic basis, but on a political basis, and then punish foreign companies that are doing some indirect trade with Iran by not investing in them. And again, I think it's an approach that is more in line with the way that the Bush administration pursued its diplomacy than the vision that Obama has presented for American foreign policy.
So these sanctions affect the Iranian middle class because they prevent certain, at least, businesses from having some kind of overseas trade, just much like Ohio businesses have overseas trade. They would certainly cut that off. Are there other ways in which they affect the Iranian middle class?
Well, I think that's a very significant way. You're talking about the development of a country's economy. If you have a wealthy middle class, then you're going to have a strong constituency who will develop interest in seeing political liberalization. We've seen that in almost every indigenous movement towards democracy. But when people are very poor, and when the state is controlling so much of the economy, then people get very dependent on the state, which then limits their ability to push for political liberalization. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, not only the sanctions, but of course Iran's own efforts to isolate itself, or its own efforts to, or its own incompetence and mismanagement of the economy has also obviously contributed to the failure to develop this wealthy middle class.
Mm-hmm. My guest, Trita Parsi, is president of the National Iranian American Council. They promote Iranian American participation in American civic life. Yeah, my guest's current book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the United States. Obviously, we're talking about U.S.-Iranian relations with a leading expert here. We're at 614-292-8513 and emails to openline@wosu.org. Well, as you point out, Trita, in your testimony before Congress last week, what we want to do, we want to stop Iran from supporting militant groups like Hezbollah and to some limited degree Hamas. We want to stop that. We want to stop Iran from moving toward the capacity to build nuclear weapons. But you say the sanctions are not having that effect. Well, what would?
I think the one approach that we really have not pursued in earnest is diplomacy. And sitting down with the Iranian government and having extensive conversations not only about these issues but many other issues, including their human rights record, and finding common solutions and finding incentives and disincentives to be able to change their behavior. We've seen in the past that when the Iranians have been included, when they have been given a seat at the table, they have at times behaved very constructively. For instance, right after 9/11, the United States and Iran collaborated extensively in overthrowing the Taliban government, defeating the Taliban militarily, and then ensuring that the next government in Afghanistan, the next constitution, would be a democratic one and that would not be based on sectarian lines. The Iranians played a crucial role in that process. And I believe it was partly because both the United States and Iran accepted each other's existence in this process. No one was trying to push the other one out. And when both of them were willing to deal with each other, a lot of positives came out of that. And we can see the same thing, I think, in many other areas in the Middle East.
Well, when President Obama gave his inaugural address, he talked about dealing with the Muslim world on the basis of mutual respect. And was that a signal to Iran? And if it was there a response?
Without a doubt, I think it was a signal to the Iranians, because the Iranians have been talking about mutual respect for so many years now. Mutual respect is an Iranian buzzword. It's not a buzzword that is used by a lot of other people in the region.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was a very clever move by the president. He's declaring his willingness to deal with the Iranians on the terms that the Iranians have been requesting. Now, what is waiting to see then is what will the actual substance of America's policy be.
Mm-hmm.
There's a review going on right now. I think it should be finished within the next 5 or so days. And that should, if properly concluded, come up with a completely new strategy on how to deal with Iran, in which we fill in the substance of what it means to deal with Iran on the basis of mutual respect.
All right. So there was no response to the president's words because the government of Iran is awaiting first action.
So there's been some responses, some positive and some negative signals from Tehran. There's been some welcoming of what that has been said, and there's been some actions that seem to indicate that the Iranians are giving some sort of olive branches. We're not 100% sure if they are or not. They could be coincidental. But, for instance, the Iranians have assembled a large number of new centrifuges, according to the IAEA. But they have not started using them for enrichment, which the IAEA head, El-Baradei, said that he believed that was a political decision, which then may mean that the Iranians are saying, look, we can do this, but in order to build trust, we're not.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Iran would, under any circumstances, or what would the circumstances have to be to get them to give up their ambition of the capability or the near capability of building a nuclear weapon?
Well, I think the problem there is that we have defined the capability of a nuclear weapon to be the same capability that you would have to have if you want to have an indigenous nuclear program that is completely peaceful.
Mm-hmm.
The enrichment component of a peaceful program for a country that wants to produce its own fuel for its reactors, which they are entitled to do under the NPT, is the same technology that also could be used for weapons purposes. And in the last couple of years, the United States has pushed for a solution based on zero enrichment, meaning that the Iranians would have no enrichment at all. But because that is a right that is codified by the NPT that the Iranians enjoy, I think the United States has had difficulty building the type of international consensus around that position. And it's also not necessarily a very effective position if you really are concerned about nonproliferation. More and more people from the IAEA are saying that the best tool to use to ensure that the Iranian program does not become a weapons program is to have maximum amount of inspections and having the additional protocol to the NPT be implemented by the Iranians, because that would enable the IAEA to do sudden unannounced spot checks in various places in Iran,
mm-hmm.
which would be the most effective way of making sure that there is nothing going on there covertly.
Sure. And they don't have the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, they don't have that spot check instant capability now, because why?
Well, they actually did. The Iranians voluntarily implemented the additional protocol for about 2 years up until the UN Security Council imposed sanctions on them. And then they ceased implementing it. And a lot of what we know about the Iranian nuclear program right now is actually coming from the period in which the IAEA could do those type of spot checks.
Mm-hmm.
And the IAEA is obviously very upset at Iran for stopping doing that. And it's realizing that when the United States or the UN Security Council punishes Iran, the Iranians in return punish the IAEA as a counter pressure.
Because mm-hmm. I mentioned the only way, as you say, of making sure that Iran is not moving toward a nuclear weapon and to understand exactly what they're doing is to have the ability to walk up and say, we want to inspect this facility right now, right?
That would be a fantastic tool to make sure that not only Iran, but future countries that will begin enriching, or even existing countries such as Japan and others, who are currently not implementing the additional protocol, including Brazil, for instance, that they also would do so, because that would really give us the best possible, it's not waterproof, of course, but the best possible guarantee that as this technology spreads, it will not spread in such a way that we will also see the spread of nuclear weapons, because that obviously would be devastating.
Trita, what does the Iranian government want in terms of their nuclear capability? I mean, do they want nuclear weapons, or are they playing an elaborate game to gain certain advantage to make us think they want them? Maybe, what do they want?
I think what they want is, in essence, similar to what the nuclear program of the Shah was, which was, on the one hand, create an alternative for gas and oil that Iran has. Make sure that once the gas and oil runs out, Iran continues to be an energy-independent country and an energy exporter. About 80% of Iran's revenue comes from exporting energy, gas and oil, and at some point that gas and oil is going to run out. So what's plan B? You've got to have a plan B of making sure that the economy can still be functioning and that Iran will still have an export industry. But also to provide them with the nuclear option. So in case there is a significant deterioration of their security environment, they would be able to move towards a nuclear weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And mindful of the fact that Pakistan has nuclear weapons, Russia has it, Israel has it, and Israel is constantly threatening to bomb Iran's facilities. India has it. Others have it in the region. Iran's security paranoia is to a certain extent understandable, but Iran's own behavior is also not helping to reduce tensions in the region and ensure that paranoia can be done away with.
Sure. Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, 614-292-8513 with Mark. Hello, Mark.
Thank you. Let me pick up here. I was listening and I almost forgot what I was going to ask. let me try to remember here. Well, you mentioned, that because sanctions have failed, what the United States should do is try to engage Iran diplomatically. And my question is, weren't other European countries, the EU, Russia, who have closer ties with Iran, especially Russia, weren't they attempting to engage Iran diplomatically while the U.S. was sitting on the sidelines that preceded these sanctions? That's why we have some of these sanctions in the first place, is because these other countries couldn't deal with Iran. And if Iran really wanted to change its behavior, it could have done so by now. It seems like it's just biding time to build up its nuclear capability. There's nothing drastic about these negotiations. I don't think they have to be that complicated, and all they seem to be doing is stalling for time. And I guess my last question is, you know, you say that spot checks are the best defense, I guess you can say, to allay security concerns of outside countries. Well, what happens in the case if you have spot checks that quit allowing the spot checks?
Okay, I believe we've lost our connection. Thanks, Marco. We believe we've lost our connection with Trita Parsi here, and he will call us back momentarily. Trita mentioned before we went on the air that his office has internet phone service, and that occasionally it goes down. So, and he will call us back in just a moment here. He didn't think it would happen, but it apparently has. Trita Parsi, the National Iranian American Council. Trita, are you back with us?
Yeah, I'm so sorry. I caught most of that question. I'll be more than happy to address it if time exists.
Yeah, and our caller has left us, has hung up. So our caller was saying, look, it looks like, didn't our European allies have conversations, and weren't they negotiating with Iran prior to our sanctions? And isn't Iran just stalling, continuing to stall so that it can have the time to build up nuclear weapons production capability?
Well, I mean, I think the caller raises a couple of very interesting points. I would say this, though, on the idea of stalling. If the Iranians intended to stall, then we did everything we possibly could to make their job of stalling as easy as possible. Nothing has enabled Iranians to win more time for their nuclear program than the refusal of the Bush administration to negotiate and be a partner at the negotiating table in diplomacy. And you will hear that from Europeans as well. And I think it's a little bit unfair to say that because the Europeans failed in their diplomacy, that means that diplomacy cannot work. I don't think we can in any way, shape, or form compare the weight that America has in its diplomacy and the capabilities of its diplomats to the capabilities of France or Germany. These are powerful states, but they're not superpowers like the United States. Mm-hmm. And the real equation here has two countries in it. That's Iran and the United States. As long as they are not talking to each other, then it really doesn't matter who else Iran is talking to. United States is the key player in this equation together with Iran. Mm-hmm. They have to talk to each other to make sure that we can say that real diplomacy has been attempted.
All right. We're going to take a short break here. Trita Parsi, the National Iranian American Council. And after these messages, we'll be back with my guest and you callers to talk about the United States relationship with Iran at WOSU 820 NPR News.
Charges against Chris Brown are gruesome. He's accused of repeatedly punching his girlfriend in the face, banging her head against the car window, threatening to kill her. Many tell Rihanna she has to leave, that abusers never change. I'm Neil Conan. Do abusers change? Join us next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
That topic and much more on Talk of the Nation. It begins at 2 o'clock this afternoon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning. I'm Amy Jurevich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. And join us tonight at 8 o'clock on WOSU TV for Pavarotti, A Life in Seven Arias, followed by Hitman, David Foster and Friends. Your support keeps programs like these on WOSU. You can support these programs by going online to WOSU.org or by calling 1-800-455-9678 and call with a generous donation to support WOSU-TV.
Support for WOSU comes from the Sherrington Group Financial Planners and Investment Consultants, providing timely guidance, education, and options to complex issues affecting clients' futures.
And taking a look at the weather forecast, sunny skies today and a high right around 70 degrees. Some clouds will move in later this afternoon, and there's a chance of rain tonight, maybe a thunderstorm throughout the evening, and a low of 40. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line. At WOSU 820 NPR News, I'm Fred Anderle. We're talking with a leading expert on Iran and U.S.-Iranian relations. Trita Parsi is president of the National Iranian-American Council. They're an organization which promotes Iranian-American participation in American civic life. And my guest's current book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the U.S. We're at 614-292-8513. You can email comments or questions to openline at wosu.org. Trita, just before the break we were talking, you said that, you know, the United States, in terms of its diplomacy with Iran, could have a lot more sway, a lot more power than dealings from our European allies. What is it about our dealings? What can we promise? What can we threaten in terms of Iran that gives us more power?
Well, first of all, the United States invaded Iraq, invaded Afghanistan, and has essentially encircled Iran militarily. United States made threats of regime change and even made threats of military conflict with Iran. Keep on insisting that the military option was on the table. You never heard that being said from any European state, from China, or from Russia. So the real conflict, essentially, has been between the United States and Iran. And if you want to solve the conflict, you have to have the countries in that conflict talking to each other instead of talking to others. As the former National Security Advisor, Dr. Brzezinski, pointed out, he said that the Bush administration outsourced diplomacy to non-superpowers like France and Germany. It just doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm. Is one of the things that Iran would be looking for in any kind of negotiation a security guarantee from the United States, a statement that we would not undertake hostile action against them, either militarily or within some kind of promoted internal subversion, given that they cooperated in not moving toward nuclear weapons production and in total weapons inspection? Is that the kind of thing they're looking for?
I think that's one of the things that they're looking for. I think they're likely not going to be asking about it up front. Rather, they're going to be asking for Iran's involvement in a lot of different security bodies, part of a new security architecture for the region, and through that create a web of dependencies between the United States and Iran that would essentially eliminate prospects of the United States taking military action against Iran rather than actually asking for a security guarantee. Mm-hmm. The Iranians view themselves as a regional power, and as such, they probably would not feel comfortable to ask for security guarantees because that kind of undermines your status as a regional power.
Sure. Well, since, as you point out, Iran cooperated with the United States and the Bush administration after 9/11 in overthrowing the Taliban and making sure that a democratic, relatively democratic form of government occurred in Afghanistan, since there was that cooperation, why did the Bush administration go on to freeze them out and try to isolate them diplomatically, given they knew there could be some mutual interest and mutual cooperation?
Well, the Bush administration had a policy of seeking to overthrow governments in the region that they were not very happy with. So even though they saw that there could be behavioral changes in Iran that were very positive and helpful to the United States, they did not view that as being sufficient. Rather, whatever they could achieve by negotiating with Iran, they viewed that they could achieve even more by just simply taking out the government militarily and imposing a new type of a government in Iran. Remember, this is all during the time when regime change was the buzzword in Washington. And, mm-hmm. We did regime change in Afghanistan, which at the time was successful, and now it's a little bit shaky. Later on, we went into Iraq, and that's where the real problems began.
Why does Iran send aid, financial aid, and I presume military aid, to Hezbollah in Lebanon? What's in it for Iran, and what are they trying to do?
Well, the Iranians have had long-standing relations with Hezbollah and probably were very involved in the founding of that movement as well. And this actually also goes back before the time of the revolution. The Shah of Iran was very interested in the Shiite minority in Lebanon because Iran is a Persian Shiite state in a sea of Arabs and Sunnis and is viewing itself as having very few friends in the region and as a result has historically sought to invest in the Shiite minorities throughout the region as potential friends and allies. I don't foresee any significant changes happening in the strength of Iran's relationship with Hezbollah. However, I do believe that given the right type of incentives, the right type of a deal, and the right type of disincentives, we could get the Iranians to pressure Hezbollah to cease hostilities towards Israel, become more of a political organization than a military organization.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we've seen that in the past. In 1989, the former President Bush Sr., in his inaugural address, said goodwill begets goodwill and signaled to Iran that if Iran took a couple of positive steps, the United States would reciprocate. The Iranians took that very seriously, and they knew that one of the key things that the United States was looking for was the release of American hostages held in Lebanon by Hezbollah, and they put pressure on Hezbollah to release them. And within a year, all American hostages were released. And this actually did create some tensions between Hezbollah and Iran. But it showed that the Iranians could put that type of pressure on Hezbollah. And there's probably not a lot of other countries in the region that have that type of a relationship to be able to convince Hezbollah to do things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. So did then relations, this is the first Bush administration, Bush, Herbert, George Herbert Walker Bush, did were there further overtures between the two countries, or was that about it?
No, there's been several overtures. I mean, we should not forget the efforts that the Clinton administration did to open up to Iran, and unfortunately, the Clinton administration failed, which was largely because of infighting inside of Iran, nervousness about dealing with the United States. So there's been overtures from all sides. Both the United States has reached out, the Iranians have reached out, and unfortunately, everyone has missed the have never failed to miss the opportunity to miss an opportunity.
Hmm. Why do you think that's the case? Given some amount of goodwill on both sides, and you say the overtures, why do they miss the opportunities continually?
Because there's been a lack of synchronization. When the Iranians have been ready, the United States has not been ready. When the United States has been ready, the Iranians have not been ready. We're now in a period of time in which it seems like both countries are quite ready. I've never seen the Iranians be as ready as they are now. And the United States have a new president who made diplomacy with Iran part of his platform in his presidential campaign, and yet he won. And now he has started to fulfill that promise by making speeches and indicating his willingness to pursue diplomacy. So this may be the first time in a very long time in which both sides actually have already at the same time.
Trudy, you say that Iran seems to be ready, but Iranian President Ahmadinejad, continues to make these provocative statements. I mean, provocative threats in the direction of Israel. He holds a conference of Holocaust deniers just a little while back. I mean, how ready is a president who does those kinds of things?
Well, first of all, the president of Iran, Senator Ahmadinejad, is not the most important person in that political system. It's the supreme leader, the top Ayatollah Khamenei, who is the key decision maker at the end of the day. But even with Ahmadinejad, I can tell you that my own impression is that mindful of some of the other things that he said and done, he is very eager to be part of a U.S.-Iran deal. He wants to take credit for it because he knows that that will benefit him politically back at home inside of Iran. And there's actually a rather shift in the level and intensity and the frequency of some of the provocative statements that he used to make. I mean, he was much more eager to go on air and make provocative statements about 2 years ago than he is today. And I think that's partly because he's afraid that if U.S.-Iran diplomacy fails, and he's been making a lot of provocative statements, people will conclude that he is the cause of that failure, and that will cost him a lot domestically in Iran.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you say the Iranian president is not the chief authority in Iran, you have something called the Guardian Council and the supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. Why did they allow him to make these provocative statements at all if it wasn't in the interest of Iran to do that?
Because this is a political system in which various factions are constantly fighting with each other. So even if many elements are not happy with some of the rhetoric that he's been using, it doesn't mean that necessarily they have all the power to be able to stop that. the Iranians have a peculiar way of looking at rhetoric. They view rhetoric not at all as being policy relevant. So they oftentimes are using rhetoric that seems to indicate that Iran is moving in a specific direction, whereas in their operational policy, they will actually move in a completely different direction. And it's, in my view, a big problem because other countries don't view it that way. They view rhetoric to be reflective of policy.
Sure.
And Iran cannot have it both ways, in my view. It cannot have a rhetoric and then have an actual policy. It's not the Vatican that can, at the one time, be a state but also then be above statehood because it's a religious entity. Iran is a state, and it wants to be a regional power, and as a result, certain aspects of its foreign policy need significant shift and change before it can be recognized as such.
Yeah, culturally, that's very difficult to understand, you know, that a state would make statements that are not reflective of its policy. What is it about Iranian culture that's different that allows that?
Well, it's about the way they, for instance, explain and they view their policy towards Israel. They, at points, at times, come to a conclusion that, okay, Iran will accept whatever the Palestinians accept, but they will not endorse it. They may criticize it and say, we don't think that this is a very good solution. We think it's wrong. We think it's unfair, but we're not going to interfere and do anything against it. And culturally in Iran, I assume that is something that is acceptable. Whereas in the West, if you state things critically against a particular solution, that in and of itself is viewed as you taking action against it.
Mm-hmm.
We're not making a separation between rhetoric and action in that sense.
Trudy, you've spoken about the government of Iran's ideological opposition to the Jewish state, to Israel. How strong? What does Tehran say? What does the government say? Are they simply opposed to the existence of Israel as a Jewish state? Are they unalterably opposed? Is there room for a movement?
There certainly is room for movement, but let's also be clear: there is ideological opposition to the Jewish state, ideologically motivated, in which the Iranians view this being an unfair construction. In fact, when Israel was creating during the time of the Shah, there was at first a UN commission of about 11 states that were investigating what to do with the British mandate of Palestine and come up with a solution. And the solution that came was recommended to the General Assembly was a two-state solution, a division of the territory between a Jewish state and a Palestinian state. The Iranian government at that time, and this is in the 1940s, run by the Shah of Iran, was on the record as being part of the minority within that commission who opposed the idea of a two-state solution, warning that if the territory is divided, and it would lead to ethnic cleansing, and it would lead to conflict for decades to come. In a peculiar way, their prediction has obviously become true because that conflict continues to linger on. But it's important to understand that this is actually a position that the Iranians have had that has some historic root. They were at the time preferring a one-state solution in which there were guarantees given to both the Arabs and the Jews of their rights, etc., but not dividing the territory into two.
Mm-hmm. So this is not an opposition founded in, let's say, anti-Semitism or it's simply founded in what would you say?
Well, there is many different aspects of it. You definitely have a religious ideological opposition to the creation of a Jewish state in historic Palestine that is held by many of the religious people in the Iranian government. You have what the Shah had, which was a practical opposition to this because he felt that this would just increase tensions. But once Israel was created, and it was a fact in the region, then Iran, under the Shah, quickly shifted its position and said, well, if this is it, then it's it. And then they started to have very extensive and positive relations with the Jewish state. In fact, Iran had a very close alliance with Israel for several decades. This was headed by the Shah, even though the Shah himself originally was opposed to the creation of the Israeli state.
So they had a very close alliance with Israel. Israel, why did that change?
Well, it changed for several reasons. First of all, you had the 1979 revolution in which the Iranians became much more ideologically opposed to the Jewish state, and they were trying to use opposition to Israeli policies and Israel itself as a common denominator between Iran and the Arab states in an effort to build stronger relations with the Arab world and gain Iranian leadership over the Muslim world. But even during that period in the 1980s, Iran and Israel continued to deal with each other behind the scenes because of common security imperatives. But by 1991, 1993, you had such major shifts in the geopolitical configuration of the region that the logic behind the Israeli-Iranian alliance, which was essentially a logic of facing common threats, those common threats evaporated, and those common threats were the Soviet Union and Iraq primarily. And once the Soviet Union collapsed and once Iraq was defeated in the Persian Gulf War, the logic, the security imperatives for that alliance diminished as well, and you started to see a rivalry between these two states emerge.
Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, an organization that promotes Iranian American participation in American civic life, my guest, is a leading expert on Iran and U.S.-Iranian relations. And Trita Parsi's current book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the U.S. 614-292-8513 with Dave. Hello, Dave. You're on the air.
Yes. Based on your analogy that their rhetoric, they're usually... their intent is the opposite of what their rhetoric would lead you to believe. It would appear that if they say right now, okay, we're just using nuclear energy for power purposes within the company or within the country, then should we assume then that they are building nuclear weapons on the side? And it's still difficult, even though the bulk of the Iranian people may be peace-loving and want to move forward with relationships with the West, it's still a fact that the people in charge, it's kind of like the inmates are running the asylum because the people who are the radicals, they're still in charge. And that's the argument that I hear with Islam all the time, is that, well, we're peace-loving people, but then why do they allow the radicals to assume and control the leadership?
Trita, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think the caller raises a very interesting point. We have to keep one thing in mind. Iran is not a real democracy in which the people have the power to be able to completely choose the type of government that they want. It is somewhat of a paradox because it's probably the least undemocratic state in the region or the least undemocratic elections that are taking place in the region, mindful of the fierce competition in the Iranian elections. But it's still not a democracy because there's severe limitations on who, for instance, can stand for elections, et cetera. So we're not facing a situation in which the people of Iran necessarily can choose exactly the type of government or the exact type of policies that they're wishing for. But asking the question of whether their rhetoric on the nuclear front is indicating that actually they are pursuing a program, I think the best way of reading Iran is to not pay so much attention to the rhetoric and start looking at their actions instead. That gives a much better picture of what their policy is and realize that sometimes their rhetoric is aimed at confusing the outside world. So looking at their actions is a better way of assessing what they're doing and what the risks are than to pay so much attention to their rhetoric. Not to say to dismiss the rhetoric, but to put the focus on their actions.
Well, and the same comparison, I think, can be made with Saddam Hussein. He gave the West the impression that he was moving forward with chemical, biological, and nuclear weapons. And that got us into the mess of invasion that we ultimately wound up in. And that's what the Bush administration believed. Okay, and not just the Bush administration, but not just the Bush administration, but the rest of the world, as well as the Democrats, including Hillary Rodham Clinton, who was in power at the time. They deceived everyone. So to me, it seems to be an Islamic or a Middle Eastern tactic to say one thing and do the other, just as Saddam did. Okay, I want the West and the world to believe that we have nuclear weapons. We don't really have them, but them believing that. So I don't know. I'm lost in the analogy.
I think it's a little bit more complicated than that, Dave. And I think also particularly the analogy that you brought up about Saddam Hussein, I think it's a little bit of an after construction to say that, oh, we were tricked by Saddam Hussein to believe that he had nuclear weapons. I worked at the Security Council back in 1998 when the inspections were first thrown out. And it seems very comfortable for us to forget so easily that the IAEA at the time said that they had no evidence of a weapons program and that they had done extensive inspections inside of Iraq and not been able to find any traces of an active weapons program. And you know what? After the war, it turned out that the IAEA was right. And if we had been more forthcoming and listening to the inspectors instead of being so paranoid about being tricked by Saddam Hussein, we would probably not have the justification or the pretext to go into Iraq, and we wouldn't be in the mess that we are in today. So again, if we had looked at actions instead of just rhetoric at that time, we would not be where we are today.
Of course, we listened for 10 years to Saddam in the same rhetoric, and we had this shell game, was the answer that the Bush administration had to the IAEA's inspections, that they were moving them around, and which a very good chance they were, probably ultimately wound up in Syria.
Hmm. Well, Dave, thanks for your questions.
Yeah. Thank you, David.
Let us go to Rick. Hello, Rick. You're on the air.
Hi. I'll kind of stumble through this. I happened to be in a coffee bar this morning, and two guys were talking about the elections, and one of them made a comment about wanting to see the destruction of the Palestinians. And I was so shocked I couldn't say anything. But we seem to take a one-way street on these kind of remarks. We react with shock immediately if it comes from Iran. And I think it comes back down to rhetoric and behavior. The Israelis have the behavior, but they don't have the rhetoric. They don't say certain parts of the Israeli populace, but they don't say they're out to destroy the Palestinians. But clearly, pretty clearly, it's a slow process of that.
Trudy, your thoughts?
I think it's a very interesting point, and a lot of people inside of Iran have actually criticized the Iranian government exactly on those grounds, that Iran is talking very tough at times without doing anything and then getting all the negative consequences of that tough talk because it's giving the impression that it's doing more than it actually is, whereas other states may be using a very pleasant rhetoric but actually engage in much more nefarious behavior and then easier getting away with it. So as a result, the Iranians are really shooting themselves in the foot by having this very aggressive rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. Carla, you made the point that that Israel's rhetoric is soft, but you say they're up to destroy the Palestinians. I don't think there's any evidence that Israel, would you agree, is out to destroy Palestinians. In fact, they're trying. Israel left Gaza, for example, and made moves in the direction of talking about a two-state solution. And of course, in response to leaving Gaza, Israel was hammered with rockets from Hamas. So.
I would say that it's a very soft, destruction's too strong of a word, but it's strangulation. It's the slow theft of Palestinian property, of life. They really have no freedom. They don't have any access. That they've been strangled off from the rest of the world as far as goods, services. And it's usually, to me, it seems like pinpricks from the Palestinians. It's in response to 40 years of this behavior from Israel, now more and more supported blindly by the U.S.
Okay, I didn't mean to get off into a dispute about this issue because this is aside from Iran, but I did want to hear your thoughts.
Rick, the book's about Israel, Iran, and the U.S.,
and we're
talking about Iranian state, inflammatory
sure
and horrible Iranian statements.
Yes.
But I believe it goes both ways, and we quickly lose track of that. We're so egocentric in this country.
Okay, well, thanks for your thoughts.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Bye.
And a few more minutes here with Trita Parsi, the National Iranian American Council, 614-292-8513. Tridi, what is the attitude of the average Iranian toward the United States and toward the American people? You mentioned that the sanctions that we thought would bring about policy changes by the Iranian government have not done that, but that they've affected the Iranian people. You said in your testimony before Congress last week that indeed Iranian people were not as wonderfully predisposed toward America and Americans as they had been.
Well, I mean, historically, and I think to a very large extent still, the Iranian people have very deep respect for American culture, for American values, and for the American people and American accomplishments. But at the same time, one of the effects of sanctions, one of the effects of the constant threat of war has changed that. And I'm hearing more and more, particularly amongst the younger generation, who we thought were going to be automatically pro-American because they want to explore the world, etc., we've underestimated their very, very strong nationalist sentiments. And it has affected them negatively in their view of the United States as a result of the sanctions, but perhaps more so the result of the recent talk about war. Now, this can again change. And I think President Obama's efforts to improve America's image abroad, particularly in the Middle East, and have a more open approach based on dialogue and mutual respect, etc., can go a very, very long way to make sure that this reservoir of goodwill that exists towards the United States in within the Iranian people will remain and hopefully even strengthen. Mm. But it will require change not only from Iran but also from our end.
What is life like in Iran today for the average Iranian? I mean, do we have limited freedom of press, freedom of expression? Does it feel like a police state? Does it feel relatively free? I mean, day-to-day living.
It's very interesting. Most people who go there expect a police state, but they don't really seem to experience one. You have severe limitations on freedom. You have severe limitations on what people can say, etc., in the media. But at the same time, people say almost everything they want on the street. It's not as if you go to a real totalitarian state in which no one dares to say a word. Mm-hmm. On the contrary, in the streets of Iran, you will hear people constantly complain and talk about the government in the most negative terms. But as long as they're just talking, going back to our rhetoric and action, as long as they're just talking and they're not organizing, the regime seems to be comfortable with letting them go ahead with their talk. The problem emerges if people start organizing to do things against the government. Then the government has proven itself to be very brutal and ruthless. Mm.
So the talk is a safety valve. They understand that how far they can let people go, and then if you organize, you're finished.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, if you organize politically and against the government of Iran, would you be likely to be thrown in jail? I would imagine so.
If there's right now several union workers that have been organizing and demanding better rights and things of that nature, and many of them have been jailed because they are seen as being part of, or it's as a pretext, being part of a larger effort to challenge the Iranian government using what otherwise would be seen as not very political issues, such as employment rights, etc. We're not talking about an effort that at the very outset is challenging the entire political structure, but the Iranian government seems to view that as an effort to start building up towards that, because that's exactly the way it happened in Ukraine, in Serbia, and other places in which we've seen velvet revolution.
So we have just 1 minute left here. Trita, is there any hope of something approaching a democracy in Iran in the near future, or is that way, way down the line?
No, I think more or less it's inevitable. It's going to take a lot of effort, of course. One of the key things that the pro-democracy movement inside Iran would benefit from is a reduction of tensions with the outside world. When Iran is in a more comfortable place, then the Iranian government cannot use the pretext of a national security threat to clamp down on civil rights or civil society organizations and pro-democracy movements. But under the current circumstances, where there has been a real threat of war, which has not been an imagined one, the Iranian government has very easily been able to use the pretext of that to create a securitized atmosphere and clamp down brutally on NGOs, on human rights defenders, and pro-democracy activists.
Mm-hmm. My guest, Trita Parsi, president of the National Iranian American Council, his current book, Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Israel, Iran, and the U.S. Trita, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. you so much for having me.
When we come back, feminist humorist Gina Barreca joins us on listener-supported WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.
Support for the Statehouse News Bureau stories on WOSU comes from the Ohio Education Association, representing 131,000 teachers, support professionals, and higher education faculty who are working for great public schools for every child. Online at OHEA.org.